This is the Amp Hour Podcast. Released February 5th, 2024. Episode 657. Automating the Home with Keith Brzezinski. Welcome to the Amp Hour. I'm Chris Gamble of Contextual Electronics.
And I am Keith Brzezinski, working at Nabucasa right now as an ESP home hardware and software developer, here to answer all your questions about all home automation things.
Yes, and I have many because I am a complete noob. You and I are not noobs to each other because we used to be at Chicago meetups together. That's how I met you.
Yes, yes. No, those were fun, hanging out at the bar and discussing nerdy hardware things and having some good food and drinks and stuff. And
it started pre-pandemic, so we actually got to hang out at a bar. And now it's coming. It's slowly making its way back.
Yeah, in the before times. It was good. We need to get more of those going now that you're kind of out east.
Not in Chicago. But,
not in Chicago.
Yeah. It's hard to make it to those meetups. It's a long commute. Okay, so you said Nabucasa, but what's the other word that people would know probably more in their soul if they've been watching this project?
The home automation platform itself. Yes. Home Assistant. The big one, for all of the home automation folks out there. Yes.
So my first exposure to this was a former coworker did like a tech talk, internal tech talk about like his setup. And I'm like, I'd never heard of it before. I'm just completely, I am a dumb home person normally, up until recently. And I don't know. I just always kind of ignored it. And then I had seen this tech talk. I was like, oh, I really loved the focus on like local control. And like you could bring in external APIs, but the fact that you can control stuff from this little box that's just kind of sitting in your house, and you don't need to talk to a Google server or an Apple server in order to actually trigger these things. That really opened my eyes there.
Yeah, I would argue that local control is not like a nice thing to have. It's really a necessity, a requirement. And especially the way things go today, you just see all of these, and there's not like dozens or even hundreds of them, but you do see a pattern of, you know, XYZ Corp makes a product and, you know, a year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years later, they decide they don't want to support it anymore. When you have a device that's completely reliant on a service that's running in, you know, AWS or Azure or GCP, wherever, then they turn it off. You've got a brick. Like you've got a brick sitting on your desk.
I mean, even GCP, they turned off Google IoT Core. So like it was that, you just killed that entire service at Google. It was like, oh, wow.
And insert your favorite Google product that they killed, last week here. It's a real pattern. Yeah. And unfortunately, when you have all this hardware that's just kind of useless. And so local control is really critical in this environment, I think, because you want to be able to continue to use these devices. You know, my light bulb can't stop working because some company went bankrupt or doesn't want to support it. I need to be able to see in my living room when I come home at the end of the day. And so that really, so yeah, so that's
and I would love to play the role of curmudgeon as much as I am a burgeoning smart home enthusiast, which I'm not really that yet. I'm just interested in Home Assistant. But like some people would say, well, then don't make it smart at all, right? Why even bother? Don't do this sort of thing. And I think that's one thing we're going to talk about here today is just like some of the interesting things you can do. You don't have to do, but there are, I think some of the baseline thing is just that there are some interesting and useful things that you can do with some of this stuff as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And you know, whether it's just a finished product that you want to get, and maybe fine tune its behavior a little bit, or if there's, you can just buy a product, plug it in, and use it. There are some products that are sold with, you know, for example, ESP Home. There's just a whole spectrum of things you can do, and the possibilities are pretty unlimited if you're willing to spend the time and or the money. But it can be a little bit of a time suck too. make no mistake about that. It is a rabbit hole.
I think that's one of the things that people do buy currently, right? So it's like if you buy what is the HomeKit? What's the Home Assistant? HomeKit and Home Assistant, that gets me confused, right? So HomeKit is the Apple thing, right? That's correct. The Apple smart home gadget. And then Home Assistant is the software that we're talking about here and the ecosystem around it. And then Nabucasa is a company that kind of shepherds some of the stuff, including ESP Home, which is what you work on, and then some of the hardware around it as well. So that's also another thing. So you need to run Home Assistant on some hardware. It could just be a Raspberry Pi or even just a generic computer, but there's also purchasable kind of custom hardware meant for this specific purpose.
Exactly. Yeah. Home Assistant in and of itself is more of a kind of the brain of the center point, or some people like hub. Hub isn't my favorite word for the, but like it's still
portal.
It's kind of the center point portal. Sure. Yeah. But it's the center point of kind of the brain of everything. And then you have these devices that you put around it that it will talk to in any number of ways. You know, that wirelessly wired, you know, Bluetooth, Zigbee, Thread, Wi-Fi, you know, there's a whole bunch of different ways you can bring things into it. But those are kind of the two parts of the puzzle. You've got your kind of hub or brain in the middle of it, and then you've got these devices that you want to control.
Right. Yes. And I just this afternoon, I finally hooked up I've had this on my mind I should do this at some point. Now that I'm on leave for a little bit, I've had some time during a nap time to install Home Assistant on a Pi I had laying around. I got it up and I was like, it doesn't do anything yet. I have to actually order some hardware, build some hardware or something like that. And now I finally ordered some hardware and it's just work. And it literally just worked out of the box. I was really surprised by that. Because
that's the goal.
Yeah, I mean, yes, right, exactly. That is I think that's the goal for really any smart home system, even if you are buying it from a Google or an Apple. But now it works out of the box and it's not tied to any vendor. That's pretty cool.
Yes.
In my case, Keith's looking at my video, but I was showing him how I have a smart switch behind me that is Zigbee based, is a Sonoff?
Sonoff, yep. Yeah.
Yeah. Excuse me. It was just basically just plug in a dongle recognized, comes up, uses ZHA with his Zigbee Home Assistant, I believe. And, and then it just recognizes there's a new device in the house and it just pairs it and I'm ready to go. That's kind of what I want for a lot of my interactions. And then you kind of write your own scripts on top of it if you want to, right? You can set triggers and all that stuff. It feels like that might be a little out of my, seems like that's where a lot of the community is. And they're a lot of kind of software IT type folks that are very into that sort of thing. I'm what do I do with this now? Kind of setting up complex business logic and or, automation logic. I'm like,
business logic. And on the flip side, you have home logic.
But it's the weekend. So it's home logic, right?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. No, the automation is the other big part of the puzzle. And I think this is where people can end up spending most of their time. And be it either the actual, be it physical implementation of the automation itself, getting the, steps that executing it basically, but you can spend a lot more time just figuring out what you need, what makes sense for your lifestyle. Some people put sensors under their beds. And so they know when they lay on the bed and lay on the bed, then it shuts off all the lights around the house and make sure that, maybe it triggers a robot vacuum, for example, because then it'll vacuum downstairs while they're sleeping upstairs. There's all sorts of things that you can do with that. How you use it, I think largely just depends on your lifestyle and, what you want it to be. And it's not always immediately obvious either. Some people I have a cousin, for example, who has a few smart light bulbs and stuff, but they just like to be able to switch them on and off from their phone. Yeah. As you have this stuff around you and you start to realize that you can do more than that, that's where the power of it really starts to become more visible.
And I was on the subreddit. There's a Home Assistant subreddit. I was on there, and that there was like some idea, you know, it's like people kind of quasi boast, but just like showing off the things they're doing, which is cool. Actually, it's like nice to just be able to see some of that stuff. Like one was like a guy walking downstairs. It did like a proximity based on like the field strength of his Bluetooth on his phone. Then it like started triggering a bunch of automations based on that, coffee and music and news and whatever.
Yep. Yeah, people do. Room detection has been a, you know, is there someone in a particular room, has been a real hot one right now. And in particular, a lot of the tinkerers are using these millimeter wave sensors that are, you know, it's still a motion sensor.
The radar ones, right?
Yeah. Exactly. And it's still basically a motion sensor. But the thing is they can detect such minute motions. They will detect your heart beating, for example.
What?
And that's how fine they are. And so you can determine if someone is in a room that way. You know, the traditional motion sensors like PIR and things like that.
Yeah.
You actually have to physically move.
You wave your arms, lights go off.
Yeah, that happened
in my old workspace. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. And that's, you know, that's real common. But these millimeter wave ones are you know, much, much, much more sensitive. And so they can determine if people are in a room. The other thing you mentioned, Bluetooth, some people, will use like one of the ESP devices with Bluetooth enabled to identify, you know, like if you have an Apple Watch or an Android Watch or something, you know, something like that, something that's just kind of broadcasting a Bluetooth beacon. It can identify the UUID of the device and you can start to pair like who's in what room and when. And there's a whole bunch of different use cases for that as well outside the scope of you know, what we're chatting about today. There are people doing that, and it's certainly possible. Yeah,
that's cool. Yeah, and I think that, you know, it does seem kind of like a marketplace. It seems like a lot of people coming together doing interesting things. Some are going to be just off the shelf type users. Mm-hmm. Some are going to be custom users, but you focus on the custom users with ESP Home. So let's quickly talk about what is ESP Home.
Yeah, so that's a great question, and I think we're still, I don't want to say struggling to define exactly, like we know what it is and does, but putting it to words is sometimes a little tricky. I think the way I would explain it, and this might sound a little daunting to someone who's never done any kind of IoT or embedded development before, but I would probably explain it as a development platform for IoT devices that aims at being pretty close to no code. It eliminates all of the boilerplate that you would typically have if, like we get a lot of people who are familiar with Arduino, for example, and then the Arduino IDE, like you don't have to do any of that. With ESP Home, you can create a YAML file. And there's actually web tools that will set up a device for you and give you effectively just a blank file with just essentially a template. And then you populate it with things that you want. So for example, if I want a sensor, like a BME280 is a real common, you know, temperature, humidity, pressure. You just put in the YAML, BME280, use this I2C bus, you give it the pin numbers, the names of the sensors as you want them to appear in Home Assistant, you know, living room temperature, living room humidity. And you click compile and it dumps it on the ESP and then it shows up in Home Assistant. You don't have to sit there and like twiddle with bits and figure out how many shifting places you've got to shift and decode the temperature. Like that's all done.
I think that's the thing. It's like once you start to assume there's some similarities on hardware, on setup, on like just the kind of the genericization of like hardware implementations, like, okay, you're just going to have this stuff. Now it's like, it's almost like that another like business logic type of thing where it's like, yeah, pin two is this, pin four is that. Now that it's hooked up, let's just go for it. Right. And so it's like, it's like more abstraction sort of, right? I mean,
yeah, it is. It does build some abstraction around all of the specifics of, and you know, I think people listening to the show will be familiar with some of the intricacies of all these different microcontrollers we have around us, you know, ST versus ESP versus Atmega, you know, 328 or, you know, there's all, despite all of these different platforms, you know, we focus on the expressive, like ESP, the 8266, 32, and then some of the ESP32 variants. But it also supports, like for example, the RPi Pico, like we have support the RP2040. So like we have support for that too, because there's a version of that with Wi-Fi, and that's kind of the only prerequisite. ESP Home is designed to communicate with Home Assistant via Wi-Fi, via TCP/IP. There's an API and so on. And so, but again, this is all kind of under the hood. As someone who just wants a temperature sensor or just like an infrared remote control is a great, another great use case for these things. Like, you don't have to know all of this stuff. It's just sort of there. And I'm getting off on a little bit of a tangent here.
No, that's good. That's good. That's actually something I like about the ESP Home site as well, because it's like kind of laying through, like going through all the different sensor components and like other types of inputs and stuff like that. And that actually, sometimes I just want to see like, what is even possible, right? This is kind of a great thing about this is like, yeah, you could kind of just see, here's the sensors that are already supported. Now go nuts with it. You know, like now think about what you're going to actually do with it, because it's the, once you are moving past, they're like, I don't need anything custom. I don't need a custom, you know, I don't need to do anything fancy aside from extracting the information that already is getting there. I don't need to write my own library for that sort of thing. Okay, just give me the data. The data is the product in that case. And then the custom board that, or sorry, the wiring that you're doing is just how you're setting it up to make it work.
Exactly. And that's like, you know, back to your point about the sort of assuming similarities between the different platforms, you know, it, the way a lot of these processors are now is, you know, just give me an I2C bus, put it on, you know, pins seven and eight, you know, and just, I don't care about all the registers and like twiddling bits and all this stuff. It's just make it happen. And this is what ESP Home takes care of for you is, you know, I define an I2C bus, I tell the sensor to use it, and there we go. So it makes it really gets rid of almost all the boilerplate. I don't want to say it's like no code. I think it's a little buzzwordy. It does largely revolve around YAML configuration files. So you define what you want in YAML. And
there's text and it's monotype. So it looks like code to me. I'm just saying.
Yeah, exactly right. You know, and there's indenting and colons and stuff. Yeah,
right. That's scary.
So no code may be a bit of a stretch. But the other thing too is it depends what you're using. If you want to use like a little embedded display, like a little OLED, you know, 64 by 128, just to show some numbers or something, you're probably going to have to write a little bit of C code to make that happen. There's not a way to do that in YAML yet. Yeah. Maybe it will come about. Who knows? But
That's actually an interesting thing to pick into then too. So like, what? Okay, so I told you before the show, I'm going to give you an idea of the things I want to do, and I think this is totally possible. So I was like, what should I plug into my Home Assistant system? Well, how about like a garage door sensor and then also a light sensor on the same board? Is that like, that seems like that's pretty easy to stick in a garage, like a, you know, like a read switch and a light sensor?
Oh yeah. Yeah. And there's a lot of different ways you could do that with or without ESP Home. There are sensors you can do light sensing. You can do a little read switch to check if a door is open or closed, motion sensing. There's a lot of ways, but yeah, like something like that with ESP Home would be pretty straightforward to do. A lot of folks, what they'll do is they'll just go on Amazon and, you know, pick up, you know, ESP32 DevKit 1 or whatever the board is. There's tons of them. Some of the boards have some peripherals, like a little display or maybe some sensors built on, whatever. And you can get them. They're cheap. They're, you know, $5, $10, $15, $20. And you're going to get two or three of them in a little pack or something. And if you blow one up, it doesn't matter. Like, don't sweat it. Just get another one. They're and honestly, I found they're pretty forgiving too. I think, you know, you're not going to fry it with 5 volts, at least not immediately, but 12, yeah, someone did. So maybe, you know, think about that. But to your point, like, yeah, you could put an ESP with a little, just to sense if the door is open or closed. You could put another one with, you know, with a light sensor on it or a motion sensor, you know, is however you want. And they take, you know, 5 minutes to set up, especially once you've gone through the process a couple times. The time from taking it out of the box to having it visible and usable in Home Assistant is no joke, maybe 5 minutes. Like,
how do you decide then? Okay, so like you had mentioned, like the case I said with like the garage door sensor, right? I just went on Amazon, like you said. Yes, you're right. There's just a bunch I could just buy that are ready to go.
Yeah.
So then from your perspective, when do you decide to then switch over to ESP Home or custom? I mean, like you said, you could do it yourself. Maybe you have some more specific specs. So like when are you seeing people reach for it to go more custom? Is it like to use a sensor they already have on hand or to get some new functionality, or why are they then going custom like that?
It varies a lot. I think for me, what usually drives me to build, you know, to lay out a board and to build some kind of solution is specifically with ESP Home is when I can't find or easily find or at a reasonable price point find a boxed product that I can get from Amazon that doesn't solve the problem like the way that I want it to. And I can give you an example, like LED controllers. I spun my own little LED controller board with an ESP32 on it, and it literally just breaks out a bunch of pins, runs them into some nice little transistor drivers for LED tape, and that's it. I couldn't find a controller that uses an ESP32. You can use an 8266 for this, and almost all the controllers that are out there are based on 8266s. But the problem is the ESP8266 has to bit bang if it wants to PWM. It doesn't have hardware to do that.
That's right.
Yeah, and so inevitably you get some flickering, and that drives me crazy. I know some people are like, oh, whatever. If you put them side by side, it's a very noticeable difference. But I spun my own board to put lamps in my living room because I just wanted an ESP32 because I didn't want to deal with flickering all the time. And so like that's one case. The thermostats is another thing, and we can talk about the thermostats too.
Sure,
but yeah. That was an interesting project that just came out of poor design of the apartment that I live in right now.
Designing in anger. That's a good starter. Yeah.
Why is my thermostat set to 85 degrees and I'm sitting on my couch in a hoodie shivering? And it's not because the thermostat is broken.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's all sorts of cases, and some people just do it because they like the platform and they just want more devices, and they don't maybe they don't trust, or they've gotten screwed over by these companies who they bought a product and 6 months later it doesn't work because they Google turned it off or something. And not to pick on Google, but
they're totally legit. Yeah. So in that case though, so are you seeing then people using ESP Home actually like on end products as well? Like they're like,
there are some,
sell products, but even just like people building a lot of custom boards as well. Not just like what point to point wiring and stuff like it, or quick headers.
Yeah, no, there are definitely a few out there that are making products. We have, there are some, I want to say light bulbs or something that are shipping with it. A lot of sensors. I've gotten some demo like sample devices from companies making some different sensors. The millimeter wave thing is huge. A lot of people doing things with that. In some cases, custom controllers for different types of heating or cooling systems. I've seen a couple of those. Those are less frequent. I think sensors in general is, and it'd be a kind of a broad category. That's just seems to be the one that most people get into, is they want to know how much the CO2 is increasing when they're sleeping in their bedroom or whatever. You see lots of things like that.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. Yeah. So then another kind of where the line is then, I know it will probably be a blurry line, but like when do you then have to switch out of YAML and using ESP Home to like the go custom? So you mentioned the OLED, but like, is there other custom functionality? Like, I mean, most of the time, most of my boards are just, like you said, flipping bits, just GPIO, simple stuff, right? So like, when are you seeing people then have to switch out of that to more custom? Is it like for like high speed timing type things?
So ESP Home isn't really like it uses FreeRTOS under the hood. So it's not so much necessarily for super specific timing, although that it does occasionally come up, people trying to tweak the main loop because it's just not going fast enough or something. How many times a second do you really need to read the temperature in your living room? Like it gets to a point where it's not necessary. And so those are the cases where like, it's probably an edge case and someone is doing something a little unusual. And so not to blow people off, but like those people kind of end up like on their own, and I don't want to be dismissive, but like, that's not what it's for.
Seem like this is like mass market, like customization, right? Like it's people that want to try a lot of different things and they need a tool to do it. This seems like a good one.
It is. And the thing is that this covers like probably 90% of like the especially like common cases. I want to know if someone's in a room. I want to know temperature. I want to know if a door is open or closed. I want to know how bright a room is, or if it's raining outside. It does all of that type of stuff. extraordinarily mm-hmm. well with a really, I would argue, really low barrier to entry for us, even for people drop into the Discord who don't know anything about electricity or electronics, and they just That's want great. A little like sensor. And yeah. it's so cool to see people getting into that. And, you know, my friend told me I could do this, or I started with ESP Home because I wanted an IR remote controller for my AV system and my air conditioner, like in one, like controller. Okay. I did a PR because I happened to have a Pioneer AV receiver, and there was no like implementation of that in the SP Home. So I wrote it, I PR'd it, and it got merged. And I still use it today.
IR remotes have staying power for a reason, I think, huh?
Yeah. Something that came about in what, like the late 60s or something. Yeah. They've been around forever.
Yeah, a long time.
But yeah,
that's great. Yeah, that's cool. And I mean, it's good to see this kind of like where the lines are kind of drawn. But it's a good point about bringing people in too. I mean, like there's so many. I feel like so many people when I hear about them working on like KiCad type stuff too, they're like, oh, I want to make a custom board, and then they run into all the idiosyncrasies, and they're like, never mind, you know. And having something in between like this is great from a code perspective. Even if, you know, like clicking boards together using things like quick headers, stem headers, all that stuff, it's like super useful to just make it even a step back from, you know, Arduino might be too much for someone at the beginning, but then this is like the drug that gets them hooked. So
especially it is the drug that gets people hooked in. And that is like, I think Paulus actually said that at one point, that was kind of how he got started into it. If I understood correctly, it's like, you want something a little bit more than what you're getting with some of the commercial products. And so you have this realization that, you know, I can get this little board and it costs, you know, $6 from Amazon and it'll be here tomorrow. And if I just, you know, hook up these wires just so, then it will do this thing and I will be really happy. And then they continue to just expand on that.
Dopamine once
you
hits.
Start to get, exactly. Cause then you get working hits and you're like
one Amazon box at a time.
Exactly. And the next thing you know, you're spending hundreds of dollars a month on things that you, lived fine without before, but no. That's right. So it's
the power goes out. My life is over.
Yeah. What now? It's a lot of fun, and it is, you know, you'll get out of it as much as you're willing to put in. Like it's definitely a bit of an addiction, and we actually joke about that on the Discord server that you know, especially new people, just welcome to your new addiction. You know, it's fun, and it's embedded about as easy as you can get. You know, like I said, I appreciate that it just gets rid of all the boilerplate, and I can have a device that, you know, up and running in literally a few minutes just to see if something will work, proof of concept, something. And then I've gotten to the point now where I just have to do custom boards for everything because I don't like having DuPont wire stringing all over.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. Well, and so we should talk about that too. So like, you know, you came into this, you said you were doing a PR to that's how you got introduced to the folks at ESP Home. I met you doing some badass projects at the meetup. Can you talk about some of those things? I mean, like, I remember, when was it, Nixie? Was it Nixie something? I don't remember.
The Nixie clocks. Yeah.
A bunch of Nixie clocks.
I drew up some Nixie boards. I wanted kind of a more modern take on a Nixie clock. And so I did that. And I had done some other projects. Really, what happened was, my dad was an electrical engineer. And so I got all of this, you know, knowledge, but, you know, second grader playing with LEDs and shift registers and things. And so I kind of got started that way. As I grew up, I sort of got distracted by the internet and went the kind of sysadmin route with, you know, playing with servers and TCP/IP and all of that stuff. And a friend of mine put me onto the Bullport Club. You've talked to Sauer before. And so I started
getting a long throwback. Bullport is still going or no? Is this still going?
He's not doing the club anymore. Sauer is still doing, I think he's actually doing software now, but
he was working. I know he's writing for the circuits, yes, the European
Euro circuits. Yeah.
Euro circuits. Yeah. Yeah.
Doing some blog posts for them. Yeah. Okay. He might still be doing that. I haven't been following, but in any event, no, the club has since been retired, but the, it just kind of got me kind of rekindled the interest in, you know, building things and circuits and boards and soldering and so on. You know, those fumes are just addicting. You start soldering and, but that was how I learned how to do surface mount, which is really the thing that tore me away from electronics in general. Was, you know, when I was growing up, everything was kind of shifting from being more, you know, through hole style to more surface mount, and like average hobbyist can't really do surface mount. It is a little bit different skill that you. It's not difficult. Like once you know how to do it, it's like, oh, this is actually really easy. It does require a steady hand and a pair of tweezers and probably a microscope, but you know, it's doable at your workbench. And once he sent a couple of kits that were really centered around surface mount work, I learned how to do that. And I'm like, oh yes. Okay. Now I know the right way to do this. And so that's when I started to like get back into making my own boards and things. And so then Nixie Clocks came about, and then I did a little infrared remote controller, and I mentioned this LED controller, and then the thermostats came out of that. And so now, honestly, it doesn't take much to drop one of these little ESP modules on a board. The RF stuff is already done. So you get a footprint KCAD and you drop it on the board, give it 3.3 volts from pick your source, and they more or less just work. It's pretty slick.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. I mean, like, yeah. And like you're saying all these things, like it's easy though. And I do think that like, we should call out the fact that it's like, you're still putting all this stuff together and you know, that
it takes time.
I put ESPs on a board before too. And I'm just like, oh, well, I'll just figure that stuff out later. Right. So like the making it all work together in conjunction, it's not like, it's not just a, you also have to make it actually do a thing. So that's also a thing, you know,
you do.
I thought the early clock, the Nixie clocks were STM as well. Is that right?
Those are using STM32. STM32 F07, I think. Mm-hmm. Those are like, it's a Cortex M0 with 48 megahertz, I think. And, you know, the usual slurry of peripherals they throw on those chips. Mm-hmm. Yeah, those were fun. And I, you know, I designed kind of a common baseboard motherboard for them, and I drew up some different display boards so you could put different sets of different types of tubes onto a common base. And that worked out really well because you could have, you know, little tiny tubes if you want, or you could have the larger ones as well. And I was pretty happy.
And where can people find these? I'm looking on your GitHub and I'm like, look, oh, there's no,
there's a tube. I do need to add some photos of those to the repo. I have some pictures, and for some reason that repo just kind of got like, I didn't forget about it. I know it's there, but it's just, I could use some pictures.
The pandemic hole. Yeah. Okay. They're not, so you're not like selling them on Tinder or anything like that though, right?
No. I've never gone to the extent of selling things. And that actually brings about another good point. I need to at some point start using PCBA. I keep building things at home myself. Just more out of like, I need to make sure I understand that process and start doing it, because I'm soldering way too many things at home. And when you start doing 0402 and you know, parts that size, I can do them, but it's getting
old. Yeah, leave it to the robots, right? I mean,
exactly, yeah.
Yeah. No, that's good. I mean, like, and it works. I mean, it's just a matter of time, and yeah, obviously you like the process, so.
I do. I will say that there's something about, like, just sitting. It is a little tedious, but it's also actually kind of relaxing for me to just sit and like, put this thing together. Yeah. And then you know, bring up, especially for design that I haven't tested. Like, it's nice to be able to sort of test sections of a board or parts of a board. Maybe I don't put all the parts on, fire up part of it, test it, make sure that nothing's going to let the magic smoke out. And then if it works, then, continue with it. But if I got a full board assembled and just plug it in and turned it on, I would still be a little nervous, even though at this point I'm pretty confident. But always get a little like, I hope I didn't screw up.
So then you're going from that. Now you kind of have more of a kind of, you know, your system, you're up and going these days. What are you then? You said you're always kind of turning these custom boards. What are some examples of some of the customs that you're turning these days?
So one that I'm working on right now, just as another personal thingy that I'm tackling, I decided I wanted to do my own little presence sensor. Since I mentioned before, people are doing these millimeter wave sensor, presence sensor things. And there have been a couple products, things people have done online where they combined one of the millimeter wave sensors and a PIR sensor. And there was a thing about PIR sensors that bugged me, and I'm going to go off on a tangent here for a moment because this is just kind of, I don't know why this bugs me. It's dumb, but hear me out. You know, you can buy these little PIR sensor modules that you either plug in and they just are supposed to work, or you can get these little boards from Amazon that have a couple potentiometers, variable resistors to like set the sensitivity. And maybe the delay, like how long it will stay on after it has detected motion before it goes to no motion. But at the end of the day, you're just getting a binary like motion, no motion. And there's, you can't really tune the behavior at all. And I realized, you know, how I started to look in like, what is the sensor element on it? How do they actually work? And so I learned about like the pyroelectric sensor and all the optics and how that all works.
I always wonder that. I have like the kinds that are just like lighting up my hallway, and I'm like, how does it know I'm here right now? So right. Actually, give us a quick give us a summary. I have no idea. I've seen them.
Right. Like most people, I think most people don't, because it probably doesn't matter, but I'm off in my little like Keith world over here. And
you walk towards the sliding doors and they open. That's right, how they work. Like, right. Well,
it's exactly. So that's all we, and end of story, we'll go home. No, but so there's a sensor element called a pyroelectric sensor, and it is basically, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. I think I am. It's basically a field effect transistor with a gate that's sensitive to heat. Huh. And so the thing is it's only very minutely sensitive, and so you get out of it
like gain is like crazy. Kind of
exactly, so you got to run it into some kind of amplification, right? And so I looked up how all that works and so on and so forth, but at the end of the day, you know, when you wave your hand in front of it, you just get kind of a ripple, and if you're looking at this on a scope, you just get kind of a ripple as something goes by. And
what is the heat? Is it literally because I'm a warm body, like walking by?
That's exactly, yes. Huh. And so you know, the sensor itself is only very, like, very minutely sensitive to this, but it is sensitive to it. And so you'll get a little bit, but we're talking about, like, sub 10 millivolts. It's a really, like, trivial signal.
So then you'll have, like, this is why these things trigger sometimes, too, right? Like, they falsely trigger if you have, like,
And so here we go. So you put a lens in front of it. That's why they always have that kind of funny looking translucent lens.
So yeah, that's like actually like one of those, what's the Buckminster Fuller thing? You know, like the dome, the half domes.
The half. Yeah. I think,
you know what I'm talking about? It looks, it's like a dome, but it's a geodesic dome.
Yes.
Right. Cause it's all triangles usually. Right.
They're, well, what they are is they're tiny Fresnel lenses, actually like pressed into the like the ones I bought. It's actually a Fresnel lens pattern, but they're offset from each other, and deliberately so that as it curves around or over the sensor element, it's grabbing like heat from different sections, and it intentionally is causing kind of like a rippling pattern. So as you move through the area where it's looking, it deliberately offsets the heat kind of like flip flops between the kind of different halves or parts of the sensor element. And so that's what helps to create initially the behavior of the, you know, this FET kind of switching between, it's never fully on or off. It's in a kind of the linear state, but it still will vary a voltage, you know, and so you can get,
I do remember seeing that, like, there, it is impossible to get low power on those, right? Cause it's like, it's always like always watching, always amplifying, that sort of thing.
You can now, there's pretty good designs that they didn't.
Maybe I was just using the cheap old ones off Amazon. That might've been the real problem.
That too. Yeah. It depends really how the circuit's designed. Like you can, these days you can get some things that do are like super low power, even when they're idle or off, and you can get op amps that, you know, use like micro amps, sub micro. I mean, it's crazy, but in any event. So I had the brilliant idea of, let's take this thing, you know, build a circuit out on a board, run it through an op amp, and run it into the ADC input on I'm using an ESP32C3.
Okay.
And that was a great idea until I realized I needed to learn about filtering. because, you know, when the radio is transmitting, especially when it's transmitting, the nice, smooth little analog signal looks like someone took a jackhammer to a sidewalk. And all of a sudden, the motion sensing doesn't work so well. And so I was chatting with I posted about what I was trying to do on the competing podcast, the Embedded FM Slack.
Oh my gosh! How dare you utter their names here?
and so someone looked at the board and was like, oh, maybe you need to do this or that. And then also the Bullport, the old Bullport Discord has a design review, or I need some help. A couple channels for that, and so I posted it on there, and a couple people chimed in, and so I started adding something, you know, more capacitors, a Pi filter, and some other things, and got a lot better, like way better. I actually can't believe how big of a difference some of that made. But it's still, when the radio is transmitting, like when it's actively transmitting, it's still causing like blips, and so I still need to figure out how to deal with that. But
the idea is that you're trying to basically make it like a continuous, instead of like an on-off thing, now it's like a continuous. You're just mapping values?
Yeah, so that's a great question. The end goal is to have a software, like fully software controllable, like ability to tune the behavior of the PIR. How sensitive is it? What is the range? And so on and so forth.
Right.
And actually, honestly, like it works, except when the radio is doing something. That's the part.
Yeah, so no streaming then. You gotta like bundle all that data or something, right?
Exactly. Or like disable the Wi-Fi. I'm not sure what the right answer is going to be. It's still very much a work in progress. Mm. But it's been neat because, you know, I'm coming at the whole electronics thing from the hobbyist angle. You know, my professional experience has really been like the sysadmin and then to DevOps and SRE. And with Nabucasa, you know, that I think they realized that I do hardware pretty okay. And so there was an opportunity and then the software development and like just it's I guess at this point in my life, I'm a little more passionate about this type of stuff. And so it was a really great kind of pivot point to get back into this and also get some professional experience doing it. And a lot of learning along the way. Like there's so much there's so many moving parts. Like I think I made the comment earlier. I look at the stuff.
Knowing all that stuff as well, like all the SRE types, like knowing how all the stuff's working in a Home Assistant also is going to help you when you're down in the bits and the bytes of an ESP, right? That's going to help you because you can look up the stack and be like, oh, actually, I know how to make that work. And that's not a problem.
Yes, exactly. All of that background is super helpful to have. And even understanding things like, you know, people complain about, you know, opening ports on their firewalls and like, you know, this and just understanding the network side of it is definitely helpful because people come in with issues and we get into some like people do some weird things on their home networks and that's fine. Like it's not a complaint. It's just that there's a certain like kind of design principle or philosophy. And like, we want to have these expectations. And when you go and set up a whole bunch of VLANs and you block certain ports and you do these things, like all of a sudden things are a little trickier and it wasn't really designed to work that way. That's not to say that you can't or that you shouldn't. It's just, you're going to have extra challenges if you're doing all those extra things.
Okay. So let's talk about, so people are listening right now. They're like, all right, well, Chris has got this booted up, so it can't be that hard. That's hopefully what people are thinking. Where should they start? What should be a first project that you use in ESP Home as like an example? How about, let's just make it personal. What should I put through ESP Home, Keith? What should I do?
So that's a great question. And I have a great answer for you. I hope you're ready. So I would actually not suggest a specific project. What I would do is I would look for a particular problem that you want to solve. There's this one annoying thing that I have to do every day, and I wish I didn't have to do it. And, you know, maybe it involves turning on a porch light. Maybe it involves, you know, did I remember to empty the dishwasher? Maybe it involves changing
all
a thermostat. I mean, who knows? But like, pick one and just, I never want to deal with this again. And so once you identify that, then you can start to turn it into a project. And this is a point where, like I did with the thermostats, right? So
got it. Yeah.
My thermostat is mounted on a wall that has directly behind it a boiler for a radiator system that heats the upper part of the house. And when the radiators run, especially when the weather is super cold and they are always running, now my thermostat says it's 85 degrees in my unit, but really it's only 62.
And I used to actually have this the opposite way, where I used to live in Cleveland, and the boiler had its thermostat like locally on the boiler itself. Sounds like kind of similar, but it was like there was no control. It was just like basically you had like, you know, you had a mercury switch up in your apartment or something like that. But I think it was all radiator based, so it wasn't even, I don't even know if that did much. And so the way that we made our, we were freezing all the time. So the way we would make it warmer in our apartments is we'd go and we open the door into the boiler room. And it worked great. Yeah. And then we would just open the windows when we got too hot. You know?
Oh, yeah. Exactly.
Really? I got a lot of green credits for that. I don't know if you know.
Pretty sure that's what my friends are doing upstairs. Where I'm living now, it's a three flat and we've got lower, middle, upper. And the thermostat for the boilers is not on the boiler, thank goodness. It's on the main floor, but the upper floor, it's at the upper floor. So all the heat goes up. And so they get pretty toasty up there. And when it's too hot, they just open a window. If it can be 20 degrees Fahrenheit, below 0 Celsius here, and they'll open a window, and because it's just, it gets too hot and dry.
Chicago. I'm not missing it this time of year, I gotta say.
Right. Yeah.
I miss the people. I miss a lot of things. The weather is not one of them this time of year. So
I'm not a fan of the winter myself either. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But,
So how did you fix it? So what did you do?
With the thermostats? So first of all, I designed and built my own custom thermostat with way too many sensors on it. Okay. If you go, here's another little mini tangent. So if you go online, you'll inevitably find, and within the ESP home community, which is the best sensor to use? And there's arguments for, the DHT11 or the 22 or the BME280 or the 680 or the TMP117 or there's just a whole bunch of them, or just get a NTC thermistor and measure the temperature that, I mean, there's so many different ways you can do it. Which one is the best? Well, what is your budget? I wasn't sure which one I wanted to use. And since they're all I squared C, I just threw like six or seven of them on a board and I figured I'd sprinkle on whichever ones I wanted. Just built it and I put them all on because I'm like, let's do a real comparison here.
Yeah. Yeah. If you ever go to manufacturing, that's when you flick them off, you know?
There we go. So, in any event, I'm extremely pleased with the performance of all of them. Which one is the best? And people argue about like self heating and the offsets this, that, and the other. I made a little. I call it a diving board. It's basically a notched out section of it with this to let the air around. That works great. But honestly, if you just want to know the temperature in your living room or your bedroom, just roll the dice, pick one. Like spend a budget, whatever. They're all kind of the same in that sense.
How are you control? So you have this measurement now. So then, what does it look like when you're actually controlling all the stuff?
So the tangent about the sensors aside. So what I did is I built multiple thermostats. So I have one that's physically wired into the heating system I have.
Okay.
And then I put another thermostat in the front room, kind of the living room, kitchen area I have. It's just sort of a big open space. And then I have one in the bedroom. The way I set it up, going back to like things to automate, you were asking about things to automate before. Yeah. So here's a use case for an automation for you. So I added an additional little sensor board specifically in the boiler room area. So that is specifically monitoring the temperature around the space around the boiler. So I know when the boiler is running and when it's not, just because that area gets hot when the boiler is running.
Got it.
And what it does, the overly way over engineered, way too complicated solution that I came up with is, normally I just take the readings from all the thermostats and average them together. And that's the temperature in my apartment. When the temperature in the boiler room increases, the weight of the reading from the wall-mounted thermostat decreases. What it begins to do is it starts to pull that thermostat's reading out by just decreasing its weight in the average. So if it gets above, I think, 80 or 82, maybe 85 degrees Fahrenheit in the boiler area, it gets to the point where the weight of that thermostat is zero. So at that point, it's effectively out of the picture in terms of its reading. We assume that the reading is too skewed at that point to be valid. So at that point, I'm basically using the reading from just two of the thermostats, the one in the bedroom and the front room. Way too complicated of a solution, but it does solve the problem. The temperature in here is extremely consistent. I don't have any like jumping around or well, weird behavior. It works beautifully.
But, well, so one of the problems I always wonder about with all these systems though, is it's like, but you're still like, it's like a bang bang system, right? It's like, all you get is off or on. The bang bang's the wrong term, right? But
yes.
You don't get like zone cooling, zone heating, right? I mean, that's always the problem in my mind.
It's not, I don't physically have the capability to do that here.
Okay.
But you could, if your house, you know, if you maybe had like a two story home or something, you could and put the flaps in to do that. You got to kind of plan it out, but, it can be done. And
I have seen radiators. They actually have, there's network radiators from some companies like that are in Europe. Cause like they're all radiator based there, and they actually have like the steam release valves where it's like a turn right on old radiators. And there's like it's like a motorized turn on those things. But is that how do you actually control stuff then? Is it just turning the boiler on and off?
So, I'm sorry.
Another question for your system. Yeah. Do you control the upper floors as well?
No. So the house that I'm in, there's radiators throughout the house. There are actually one or two in the basement here, but there's not a sufficient number of them to properly heat the basement. So when they remodeled this part of this house, they added a small furnace. So I've got a forced air system to the couple of radiators, which I'm pretty sure are just buried behind one of my walls here. But regardless.
Okay. So more control points, basically.
Yeah. So the control for my space is specifically for my living area. And then the upstairs, that's the upper two spaces, apartments is where they depend on the radiators entirely. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not controlling the radiators. I didn't touch the radiators at all. I just wanted to not have to sit. The other problem is like some people were like, well, just turn up your thermostat. I can't turn up my thermostat because when the boiler runs, the reading is skewed. But when the boiler shuts down, it's no longer skewed.
That's so, right.
It doesn't, it like you can't just
like separate systems. So
exactly. I really have to either just not use the reading from the wall thermostat, or I have to, you know, diminish its weight. And the only reason I did the whole thing with waiting and like slowly lowering its weight and the average is just to keep an abrupt, like if it's just a binary, like use it, don't use it.
Yeah.
That will cause a temperature jump because the average will change abruptly because now you've removed a reading that is still, so you could potentially see the temperature change by 2 or 3 degrees and that'll start to skew. So I wanted to have something that would gradually remove that value. So that's why I did that approach.
That's great. I mean, and I think that's a good example here though, too, because it's basically like, you know, you can buy systems like this, but then going and you could potentially go and buy a new controller, HVAC controller, that it does this, but I'm guessing that to that much level of customization would actually be really hard to find.
That's exactly right. You can't quite get that much customization. You certainly have like, I think Nestor Ecobee, like I know for certain you can get remote sensors for those. I don't know that they let you control the behavior of those sensors to like quite this degree. Right. And so that was, and I figured like, a thermostat is actually a really simple device. And some people might be like, no, it's not. I think it is.
I think only because people are worried if it doesn't work, right? I mean, like when it stops working, then you're kind of in a pretty bad spot, right?
And potentially very dangerous. Well, and so that brings about another good point. It's still like, okay, now I've created this thermostat, and yes, it's, you know, Home Assistant is doing this averaging because remember the ESP, different ESP devices are not talking to each other. They only talk to Home Assistant.
They're dumb, right? They're not dumb, but they're smart enough to send sensor readings, right? They're sensors.
They can stand on their own 2 feet, but they're not going to like run the whole show, you know? And so inevitably the question comes up, well, what if my Home Assistant is down? And my initial answer to that is we'll just make sure that doesn't happen because that's an easy thing to do, but it's much easier than
there's the SRE right there.
Exactly. Right?
site reliability engineer, is that what it is?
Site reliability engineering.
Yeah.
But and it is like that. It's easier to solve the problem of make sure Home Assistant is never down than it is to try to get ESPs to talk directly to each other with some kind of peer to peer infrastructure, and then then because that's another layer you've got to manage now, and so on and so forth. So regardless, I digress. But so what happens when Home Assistant is down and this averaging isn't working? Well, the thermostat understands, like my thermostat, I should say, understands when it is receiving updates and when it is connected to Home Assistant and when it is not. So if it either stops receiving updates, or if it becomes disconnected from Home Assistant or disconnected from the Wi-Fi, which of course would imply that it's disconnected from Home Assistant, then what it'll do is it will just rely exclusively on its internal sensor. So it'll continue to function as a thermostat just fine, and it will regulate the temperature, but it's not going to have the benefit of the whole averaging
less thing. Optimal, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So it won't stop working, you know, and that's the most important part. A thermostat can't quit working. So, that problem was solved and life is good.
Like I said, no longer shivering in your living room. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. So it worked out.
It is interesting too. Like the scale of this stuff, like it does seem like it kind of goes from this, like, you know, like you're saying, low level temperature monitoring all the way up to, like, I've seen like camera feeds being pulled into Home Assistant too. It does seem like the scale difference of that is significant, right?
Yes, and I have to say one thing that I don't think we've brought up yet is the understanding the scale or the capability of Home Assistant is, like, because of how Home Assistant has grown and because of, like, who uses it and who is ultimately maintaining it and continuing to build it, the community, like, people are buying these products because they want to solve a problem in their home, something they don't like, they want to fix something. And inevitably someone buys a product that maybe doesn't quite work the way they want or doesn't integrate the way they want. And so they contribute to Home Assistant, they contribute to ESP Home to make their solution available to others. And because of that general pattern, it has grown to the point where it supports so many things. It's almost more difficult to find something, a product that won't work with it, than it is to find a product that will. It's really got a very high degree of compatibility, and you know, some things work better than others. I think that's true of anything, but I could just go on and on about how great that is, you know, it's less, as a consumer, it's comforting. Like it really is, to know that the longevity will be there, the reliability will be there. That I have a whole range of choices now, as opposed to being locked into one particular ecosystem that maybe doesn't solve or doesn't even have a solution for something, you know. So it's interesting.
Yeah, I feel like it's always been possible, but I think I always think about, like, those installer companies in, like, the 80s, you know, like, where they would just come in and they would trick out your home with all these, like, switches on the wall and all this crazy stuff. And it was, like, often very bespoke. And but now it's just like, you don't need any of that stuff anymore. You just need a little bit of time on the weekend and Amazon or low cost hardware. Like, just the hardware is ubiquitous and so cheap. It's really crazy how cheap it is.
And that's another thing I like. And the ESP, like I mentioned, the ESP modules themselves are, you know, $1 or $2 for just the module. You want these little dev kit boards from Amazon, you can get like a 3-pack of them for $8 or $12 or something like that. They're so inexpensive. And they're easy to work with. Honestly, I think that the initial bring up has gotten to the point where it's just so quick and easy. It's like, why, you know, I understand if you're not a tinkerer, and especially if you just don't get technology, don't get engineering. You know, I certainly have family members who would never touch this stuff, right? But, like, for someone who's maybe just a little curious, you know, and children, adults, I mean, whatever, it doesn't matter. Like, if you've got just a little bit of curiosity, it's so easy to pick it up and run with it. Even the barrier, like Arduino, is really broke down that barrier for, you know, like the old 328 chips, or the, what is it, what were they, 186, 168s before. Like, they made it a lot more accessible, but this is like the next level of that. It's, yeah, it's even easier, especially because it.
Well, I think there's another layer up there too, right? Like I remember seeing, I think it was on the Home Assistant Reddit channel, that that little like finger thing. It's like a button pusher. It's like you can actuate it.
Yeah.
It just like pushes a button or flicks a switch or whatever. Yeah. And, I'm obviously using my finger as I'm showing Keith what this is to explain it. But it's like a little plastic actuator basically, and it's just like meant to like flick light switches, whatever. It's like a retrofit tool basically, like that. Yeah. Most of the time, that's gonna like, what doesn't that fix, you know? Like stick that's like most of what we're doing, like is a little ET finger, you know?
The door locks where it's just like a thing that fits over the handle that you rotate to you know, set or on engage or disengage the deadbolt. Like
I remember I had a client, I had a potential client, someone called me up to do a consulting job a couple years ago, and they're like, I have a server in a building that is not accessible unless you get a car for 5 hours. What would it take for you to design a finger that I could trigger with a cell phone? I just need a trigger with a cell phone, a finger, a little finger to hit a reset button. I'm like, oh, well, this is possible. But that's what like literally that's what most people like. That is a very valuable thing, because you think about it's the product is not the finger. It's not the cell phone. It's the 5 hours. It's removing 5 hours. That is the key thing.
It's and it's funny you mention that too, because there are definitely, I have seen, I can personally recall on several occasions at this point, people who've dropped into the ESP Home Discord and been like, I want to know how I can make an ESP push a button on my desktop PC, you know, and like,
that's how people start thinking about it too, right? I mean, it's like, and also like in my mind, it's always like the Rube Goldberg machine where like at the end, the basketball hits the umbrella, but then eventually you know, it just triggers a little finger.
Exactly. It does, and that's a lot. Like sometimes that's just all you need, you know. And these things can solve that problem, and it's again pretty straightforward. I just it's really fascinating to see all of the different ways that it gets applied. One in particular, the I think it was someone was using the therm, because I did a lot of work on the thermostat component in ESP Home. Someone was using it to regulate like an ice chest or something for their when they were like catching fish on their yacht. Like it just hear these weird stories, and there was something I wish I could remember the specifics, but I was just like, So you're using it to control a refrigeration system, and it pings you if you leave the door open or if someone leaves the door open, because then the fish will spoil in the ice chest, and like that would just be really bad. But like it's interesting, like you get these kind of totally valid use cases, but they're just like, I wouldn't have thought of that. I wrote the thermostat with the intention of like it's going to be in your living room or your bedroom, and it's just going to switch your furnace or your air conditioning on or off, you know, and but you start hearing the things like that. And the sprinkler controller is another one I worked on that was like, the sprinkler controller, someone came, could you pause the sprinklers? And I'm thinking like lawn irrigation, right? Like for your yard. And I was like working on this, and we had a thread going in Discord, and one guy said, can I pause it? Why would you want to pause the sprinkler system? Pause it. Well, they've got a reservoir that they're like drawing water
from. Washing a dog? Oh, no. Yeah, sometimes the dog jumps out. You need to like pause it. Right?
You need to pause it. Exactly. Yeah. Just, you know, he went out of the yard. Wait till he comes back. No. But no, they have a reservoir, and they like wanted to pause the watering cycle if the reservoir like ran below a certain level, and then they would resume it after some runoff would come, and they would. Yeah. So it just, I would have never thought of that. I wrote it initially with it would just iterate through however many zones you gave it, and then it would shut off, and you're done. You know. But it's the community comes up with uses for these things that are just really interesting and sometimes a little odd, but you know, you hear about it and it's like, oh, that's it's cool that you thought to use it that way. That doesn't apply to me. So like, why would I think of it, you know?
Right. Right.
But learning about the and just seeing some of the issues that people are trying to solve, and it's such a spectrum, and it really is fascinating. At the end of the day, I get a kick out of watching that part of it, and certainly, you know, helping people when I can. Sometimes it can get a little exhausting, but
that is tough. I mean, it is by definition, it's like beginners, and like that's there's just, you know, everybody comes in with a different context and different problems, and so like you have to kind of level set on like, well, what are you really doing and trying to do? And that is you're doing good work there, man. Like that's doing the Lord's work, you know, like that's great. But yeah, it's not easy. Not always easy.
It's not, but it is. I will say it's funny. Even when you get like really frustrating problems, it's just fun. And especially like at the end of it, that again, that dopamine hit of like, yeah, we figured this out. You know, it's pretty great. So I enjoy that a lot.
I want to round it out and come back to Nabucasa, the company you work for, and the hardware you guys build as well. I want to talk about that hardware. And then also you guys have like a system. So like this could all be local, but then there's also a cloud service that you sell where it's basically like now you can kind of tap into that from like, you don't need to be on your Wi-Fi network with your phone in order to check if your garage door is open. Now you could be out of the grocery store and check it without like a DNS bouncer or a
That's a great question, and I'm glad you brought that up. Kind of getting back to the, you know, like cloud versus local thing, I would generally argue that it's a lot easier, as you know, XYZ corporation, to make a product that just attaches to a cloud, and then you have an app on your phone, and then your app talks to the cloud, and the light bulb talks to the cloud, and now they're connected. But now you're dependent on the cloud. If you lose your connection, it doesn't work. If they go bankrupt and shut down,
your firewall's open too, right? Don't forget that.
Maybe ports on a firewall need to be opened. Who knows? So Home Assistant has the ability to connect to a cloud service, but it is not a requirement. If you want an easy way to set it up so that you can access it remotely, this is where Nabucasa Cloud comes in. And so you, Nabucasa has a it's a subscription. I believe it's $650 a month.
$650 a month in the US.
And I think there's a yearly one now you can do. I think it's $55 a year. So there's a little bit of a discount if you do a yearly. But that amount, like that subscription, directly supports us as Nabucasa employees. There's no like middleman. We don't have investors or anything like that.
So Keith, you got to switch into the telethon mode now.
Exactly.
Right now, you're supporting promotion. Jobs like mine. And,
exactly. Yes, you help us develop it,
and you get a tote bag,
t-shirts, and hoodies. But it does. And I think a lot of people, Nabucasa is founded on the basis of like just supporting this as a project, as an open source community project, because it has become so big that people cannot manage it in their spare time. It really needs a dedicated staff, and even ESP Home is getting to that point where like we need at least a couple of dedicated people to, and Jesse Hills is the other one. He's in out in the down under in New Zealand. He's really the lead for ESP Home, and I'm trying to support, you know, as much as I can in terms of PRs, and we're doing all sorts of things. But in any event, the subscriptions to Nabucasa Cloud are what support us to be able to do this. I think it's important to mention, only because like we don't have investors that are telling us like, oh, you've got to support, you know, this particular Google product, or you know, Apple wants or you know, Samsung wants that or whatever. It's really us supporting the project to support the community needs, and I feel like in that sense it's very noble, and I think it's really great that we have there's a lot of people supporting, and it helps us grow. It helps us move the project forward. It even helps us, like we are in some sense, we've been debugging code from like other vendors to fix so that they work better together, because we do testing of a lot of products like Zigbee products and Thread and so on. And sometimes they don't work the way they're supposed to. Like we've come into cases where like we're helping them identify those issues and fix those problems so that it makes everything, not just Home Assistant, but other products that are out there, it helps to make them better. So it's necessary in that sense. The other perk with the Nabucasa Cloud is the voice, that we just came out of the year of the voice, which you may have seen a good bit about. And so we added support in Home Assistant and ESP Home to an extent, to be able to deal with like voice requests, you know, turn on a light or turn on a fan or whatever. And
that's, again, that's local now, or that's cloud based again?
It works. It will work all locally. Now, this again is a thing where if you want, if you subscribe to Nabucasa Cloud, then you can connect it, and it will then it performs a lot better that way. It'll run sure, on a sure. CM4 or like models, in a high right? yellow. Mm-hmm. Like it works, but it is a little sluggish. Probably a little bit more sluggish than people like. Now that's not to say that it's slow. It actually responds pretty quickly. But Google you're going to wait.
These days is so slow in my house. I've got like an old version, and it's like.
Yes.
Computer. Hello, computer.
Yeah, yeah. And so the struggle is real, but it will run locally. But the caveat is that how well it runs locally is very contingent upon what hardware you're running it on. On like a CM4, you know, especially a Pi, if it's an older Pi, like something probably like Pi 3, for example, it might take 10 seconds to respond. You're probably just not going to love that. So this is where Nabucasa Cloud comes in as a solution to that, because you can connect it to the cloud. And then what it'll do is it'll send that, it'll get processed in out there, and then it'll come back. And it happens. It is so fast. There are some videos on the Home Assistant YouTube channel of the response times, and those are not edited. Like those videos are actually how it responds. It's, you know, more or less instantaneous. It's really, really cool. So again, the Nabucasa is just here to support those things, and the subscriptions support us to support those things. And even if you just want to support the project, but you don't want to have the cloud connections, like you can do that. Just get a subscription and don't set it up. Certainly people do that. So that's really it. And then, you know, we do have some hardware. Well,
hardware. Yeah. I was going to say that's also, cause I think that people that are, you know, so like we have listeners all across the spectrum. I think even the ones that might be very electronic savvy might not be Linux savvy, whatever. Mm-hmm. But then this is kind of an all-in-one. You can get so there's the two or the yellow and the green, right?
Yes. So we started with the blue, which was a Odroid N2 board with a custom enclosure. And then when the Pi 4s came about, and particularly the CM4 module, they designed a board. Now, this was before my time with Nabucasa, that they designed a board that's a carrier for a CM4 module. It has an NVMe slot, a Zigbee and Thread radio, and a couple of other bells and whistles. There's a PoE version of it, which is really slick, because of course then you can remotely power cycle it if something really goes off the rails. But I don't remember the last time I had to do that. It's very stable in my experience. So that's available, and those are still available. The blue is no longer, I think you can still get the Odroid N2 board that it was, but like, we're not selling those anymore. The yellow is still available. And then the green is the latest product, that is, you know, quote unquote Home Assistant hub. And the green is just aimed at breaking down the barrier that is setting up a Raspberry Pi or other single board computer. The green is very much designed to be a take it out of the box, plug it to power, plug it to Ethernet, and you're like, you don't have to deal with,
you ship, know, it to my like, folks basically. That's what I'm thinking.
That's exactly right. Yeah, ship it to my folks or other, you know, family member who knows nothing about computers but maybe can plug in a cable or two. So that's who that's for. So it's you know, the price point was $99, so it's a pretty low barrier to entry, even in that sense. And it's really a set and forget solution. You know, it's not aimed at pleasing advanced high tech users. You know, even someone like me, like it's not really a good fit for me personally. I'm doing things a little bit more advanced than that, but for someone who's never seen or used Home Assistant, but maybe is unhappy with HomeKit or SmartThings or Google. This is a really great solution.
Configurability too, right? I mean, like it basically takes it to the point where like, so like if I can just walk people like through words and like what it looks like, you know, you go to your Home Assistant local address. It's just a web page. And then it's like everything is then in the settings menu where you're adding new, if you add new devices, they're added there, right? If you're adding new services, they're added there. Like everything is there. And then it just pops up on your home. I mean, you can go and customize everything, of course, but it's all software customization and scripting at that point, right?
And there's a lot of auto discovery that happens too. You know, if you have a number of devices already, you know, smart home type devices, you know, light bulbs, thermostats, my friends upstairs have a little litter robot, like litter box for they've got cats. It's just this big like drum thing that kits in and it rotates, but it's got Wi-Fi. Home Assistant auto discovered it. I just one day I looked at my network and I was looking in the settings and I'm like, what is litter robot? Because we're sharing our Wi-Fi. And I'm like, what what is
I'm going to scare some cats.
And I'm like litter robot, you know what? And so, but I mean, it's got a password, but I told him, I might try to get him to use Home Assistant. Cause they've got enough devices up. They've got like Philips Hue, and they've got the litter robot. They've got a couple of speaker. I forget what it is, but I might try to,
I never understood the Philips Hue thing. I mean, like personally, it's very popular, right? But it's I don't get it. Aside from like the thing that I always think of, like when I think of like a home automation type thing, like my pinnacle apex experience is the clapper, and then it turns on the crystal ball and the Barry White. Like that to me, you know, lowers the thing, and then the bar comes out too. Like that is like in my head, that's what home automation actually is.
There you go. Yes, it's totally flashy.
Yeah. Yeah, like that was in the 70s, right? And that's like in my head.
The old Clapper and X10, the old X10 from Radio Shack and wherever else were back in the day. But
home automation is not new there. It's just, you know, it's just there's more software now.
It totally is. And that's the thing. Like so many of these devices now are running, you know, there's maybe like five or six different processors that go into like 95% of these devices. You know, ESP, NRF, or some of these
EFR.
So I mean, there's then the Scilabs, yes, and then there's another, what is it, Beacon, or maybe Realtek, but there's a couple other kind of more bespoke processors that some of them are using, and to try to break away from the super hackable ESPs.
Yeah, there was that that article recently, huh?
And honestly, some of it is just security through obscurity. Like they try to use weird products just so that people don't understand how they work, and then, you know, security. Inevitably they get hacked and so on. Espressif has got a really, really popular, well-known line of chips at this point. And I kind of like, I could probably talk my grandma through flashing one of them. Like,
how often is it that, so like on Home Assistant too, like how often is it that the end device is getting reprogrammed? Is it usually just using the stock firmware and then it's compatible, or is it often people are digging in, finding SWD pins?
That's another lovely question. So the classical engineering answer, it depends. You know, there are some vendors who are releasing, you know, like shrink wrap box products that you buy it and it will never get a firmware update. There are others that are pretty good about releasing updates. One of the perks about ESP Home in particular is that you can spin your own firmware updates and you can update them as much or as little as you want. You know, for me as an ESP Home developer, I'm updating things a little more aggressively, but some things more than others, largely just to make sure that stuff works. But
you might be buying an off the shelf thing, but then you're opening it up and reprogramming it outside of the
I have done that.
You don't disregard the sticker keys, do you?
I would be really upset about voiding my warranty on this $13 product. and that's also kind of the thing, right? Like if I'm buying you know, like an air conditioning unit that's like $600 or $700, I'm going to be a little more hesitant to open that up and potentially break it than something that is, you know, the sub $20 on Amazon and I'm going to get a 3-pack of them or whatever. Like I just bought a set of these Shelly energy monitoring. It's just a relay with an energy monitor and it connects to your Wi-Fi, but they have an ESP32 in them. And I literally just got them about a week ago. So I haven't really tried to tinker them, but they're like hermetically sealed. I am debating if I want to try to open it, crack it open or not, because the firmware that they're shipping them with works fine. And as I would love to put ESP Home on them to tinker with them and mess with them and sort of fine tune and maybe tweak the current sensing and so on, you know, but, you know, do I want to spend the time doing that, or, you know, how important is it? I have other things that I need to be focusing on. So it kind of comes down to time a lot of, and some products are really easy. You take out a screw and the cover falls off. Some of them, they're sealed, you know, they're epoxy resin, whatever. And like, if you open it up, you're not going to do it without destroying the case. And something I'm plugging in the wall, I probably don't want to destroy the enclosure. So there, you know, that there's a lot of different things that weigh in, and I hesitate to give anyone specific instructions or guidance on what they should or shouldn't do, because you really need to judge what's a good fit.
Yeah,
what you're comfortable.
I was just kind of curious if that's what the community is doing, like, you know, like,
oh yeah, people, there's a whole Reddit thread just on hacking those shutter devices. And and you know, it varies, you know, and what people are comfortable doing. A lot of people are generally afraid to tear open something that's going to have, you know, 100, 200 volts rolling through it and, you know, coming out of the wall, utility power. And I totally understand that. Like, I'm not really afraid to do that, but also, like, it is an approach with caution thing. Like, I'm not afraid to stick probes into a wall socket to check the voltage. Some people are. So it's really up to you.
That sounds good. Where are some resources that people could find on this stuff, I guess, generally then too? Is it like Discord is kind of the main go-to?
So we have a very active ESP Home Discord with some honestly really, and I mean this sincerely, some really wonderful people who are extremely dedicated to helping you figure out why your thing isn't working, or getting you started, or telling you on occasion that you probably shouldn't do that. but we try to be very encouraging and supportive of people. So Discord is definitely very active if you join us there. And there's a link to the Discord from the ESP Home homepage, which is just real simple, esphome.io. And so there's that. And the ESP Home website is kind of just a dump of all the things that it supports in terms of hardware, with some reference materials and a little bit of guidance. There's a esphomedevices.com, esphome-devices.com, I believe, is another site that just lists things that you could potentially put ESP Home on.
Okay.
Of course, the Home Assistant community in general is also out there. At Reddit, there are very active, there's an ESP Home subreddit, there's a Home Assistant subreddit, and those are extremely active. I like Discord just because I feel like it's a little bit more real time in terms of the communication, and there tends to almost always be someone there who's willing to answer a question. Even if they don't know the specific answer, they can probably get you in the right direction. So that's a thing. And then, of course, ESP Home and Home Assistant 2, it's all open source. So if you want to look at the code.
Did we even say that at the beginning of this?
Yeah.
Assumed.
Probably, I mean, an important detail. It is. Everything is open source. You can get the code. You can clone the code. You can hack away at it. You can customize it to your heart's content. You know, the one thing that I do kind of cautiously point out to people is that, you know, there are, because of what ESP Home is and does, it's, you know, essentially for building firmware for embedded devices that's customized to support the specific hardware you've attached or connected. We certainly have people who will go in and modify and make their own tweaks and customizations. And ESP Home's approach is that we support doing things that you can do with the YAML configuration. When you start hacking away at the C or C++ code that ESP Home consists of, you're getting kind of into uncharted territory. Now, it's not to say that we won't help you or don't want to help you, but like, understand that if we're to provide support for something, Darby Dragons, exactly. Yeah. And we want to support people, but like, we can't support every possible configuration of everything, especially when you start changing code. And so it's happened a couple times where people come in and they're like, you know, this stopped working. And it's, well, what did you do? And then you get into, you know, like a really long conversation that they've gone in and changed a bunch of things, and we refactored a component, and now their little hacks don't fit into that puzzle anymore, and so they're upset because they got to rewrite. And like, we still want to help you get your thing working, but like, understand that like, we want to support things in a kind of a known way, and this is hard to do with embedded devices. It really is, because you can have a wire on a wrong pin, and now your I2C bus doesn't work, and your sensors don't work, and you get weird error messages in the log. And so, having a clear picture of what's going on when we're supporting or trying to help people figure these things out, it's really important. So, keep in mind, if for the hackers out there, and I'm among them. I've been in these situations. You need to communicate clearly. Yeah. what you have, what you've done, what the logs are telling you, and so on. So
cool. All right. That's great, Keith. Thanks so much for joining here today. I really appreciate it. And I look forward to seeing more stuff develop on ESP Home and Home Assistant and trying it out. And now I can just call you up anytime I need. Right?
You can, sir. I will always answer. I'm happy to ping. I'm on the Discord too. You find me there. You can.
Yeah, that's whatever. That's the real answer. I'll go to the Discord. No special training.
I want people, like, we do try to push people towards a Discord, but you are welcome to text me. All right.
Thanks again, Keith. It was good to have you.
Yes, absolutely.